This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Your eyes on the times, you walk ready to speak up, but with so many problems, you're exhausted trying to keep up.
This is the Church Politics Podcast, where you can get political commentary from a biblical worldview. We're not trying to be conservative or progressive. We're trying to be Christian in the public square.
And I'm black as heaven. I'm made in God's image. Nobody can change my settings. Amen. Cut off my knees and put an end to my search. It's easy to sell your soul when you don't know what it's worth.
With your no good Ann Camp, you're listening to the Ann Campaign's Church Politics Podcast with Justin Gibney, a.k.a. Bishop Cooper's grandson, and the Windy City representative, the baddest brother above the Mason-Dixon line, my play cousin, the right reverend, Christopher Butler. Chris, I want to start this off with an apology, really. I noticed that last episode, my mic wasn't on, so I was just speaking into the computer. And it's disappointing because we just hired Slewfoot Sammy. If he keeps doing this, you know, you got to at least hook my mic up, Slewfoot. You know, you got to at least get that right now, this early on, brother. So let's hope Slewfoot doesn't, you know, make this mistake again. If he does, he might not be here with us. And I don't want to seem like a tyrant because I know I talked about I fired Chris a couple weeks ago. But that just can't happen. I apologize to you guys because I know the quality of the podcast last week wasn't what it should be. But I want to do, you know, everything that I can to make sure that you don't blame me. I want to make sure we put that blame on somebody else. So I want to start this conversation with that. All right. But I want to go into something else, Chris. How you doing though, man?
Oh, I'm doing quite well. How about you?
I'm pretty good. Now, I know, you know, there's been a lot of talk about American politics going through this like racial realignment. The Financial Times released an article that was, I guess it was talking about a New York Times poll, but it was showing that Democrats are rapidly losing non-white voters. And here's one of the quotes from the article. It says that Black Americans who lived through the civil rights era still support the Democratic Party at very high levels, but younger generations are wavering. There's also the weakening coalition between income and voter choice in U.S. politics. The image of the GOP as the party of the wealthy country club elites is dimming, opening the door to working and middle class voters of all ethnicities. I bring this up to you because I know we had in one of our chat groups, it came up. What are your thoughts on this supposed realignment, Chris?
Yeah, I think there certainly is a realignment that's happening everywhere I go. Younger people, especially men, are moving away from the Democratic Party. But I think it's a huge mistake for the Republican Party to assume that that movement is coming toward them, because they have a lot of work to do on that side to make the Republican Party a welcoming place for that population. Right now, it's a shift away from the Democratic Party. And if I could wish a little bit and hope and dream, Justin, my hope would be that something new and different other than this kind of locked two-party system might emerge from this. But, you know, We'll see.
I hear you. Shout out to the Solidarity Party. Yeah, I'm with you, man. I mean, I do hear a lot more folks in my community questioning the Democratic Party or just kind of walking away from it. But I don't hear a whole lot of folks saying, man, this Republican Party got it going on. This is where I'm going. So I don't see that happening in the way that some people may hope. And I don't actually even think the Republican Party is making too much of an effort to make that happen. There's an opportunity. I mean, if they were to focus on family-based policy, stuff like that, change the economics, but I don't know. Even with that, I think the Democratic Party, now they're getting more of your kind of white suburban voter. They're still getting older Black voters. Those are super voters. So it ain't like the Democratic Party in this moment is just in dire straits in regard to voters. Now, they should be concerned, I guess. But, you know, they have some pretty strong voters, because even though they're losing some younger voters, they're gaining these more elite voters who actually are voting a lot. So we'll see what happens. Chris, can you tell, you know, a lot of people don't know that if they go to our Patreon, patreon.com/churchpolitics, that they can actually get premium episodes. Tell them what we'll be talking about in today's premium episode. So the people who are part of our Patreon and you know, are donating money every month, they're going to get to hear this topic. You're not going to get to hear in this particular episode, but go ahead, Chris, explain what that is.
Yeah, we're talking about, we're going to be responding to a question from one of our patrons, which is another benefit that you get if you become a patron. You can actually ask questions that we will respond to on the podcast. We had a conversation about Donald Trump's overtures to the Black community by means of putting out sneakers and how kind of maybe a little offensive that was. And one of our patrons reached out and pointed out some things that some of the sort of talking head class had to say about white rural voters. And so we're going to take up that discussion on Patreon. I'll leave it right there because if you want to hear.
So there's a new book called White Rural Rage. We're going to get into that, some of that stuff. And you might imagine it connects with our civic revival 10 disciplines that may have something to do with how we treat this. But anyway, as always, I got to give a shout out to all our patrons, all our supporters for supporting us in what we do and how we do it. We will continue to talk about the tough issues in a real way that you will not see on mainstream media and a lot of other places. But to get that out, we need your support. So continue to support us. We definitely appreciate it. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure that you like and subscribe so we can get into this algorithm. And we're trying to get our YouTube game up. We do really well on iTunes and Spotify, but we're trying to get this video a little tougher. So help us out on that if you don't mind. But as always, grab your Bible, get your mind right, and prepare to think not like a Republican, not like a Democrat, but to think like a Christian. And I want to start today off with a scripture. I want to start in 1 John chapter 1, verse 9. And it says, if we confess our sins, he's faithful and just and will forgive us our sins and purify us of all unrighteousness. Chris, sometimes we just have to, I don't know if this comes to the point of sin, at least this first thing that I'm about to say, but sometimes we just have to apologize. And I want to make it an apology to the listeners, because one of my friends who's very close to the AND campaign, who listens to the Church Politics podcast, had a criticism. And he said, you know what? You guys have been talking a lot about what's happening in Gaza. And he understood why. But he said, you've been doing that at the expense of talking about places like Haiti, for instance. And so you're covering a lot of stuff you're covering it differently, but you're covering some of the same stuff that people would just see in mainstream media. And when I first heard it, I was like, man, I don't know about that. But I thought about it. I looked at what we had covered, and I think there's something to it. I think we have spent a lot of time, and this does not lower the importance of what's going on in Gaza whatsoever. But there are a lot of other people suffering in other places, and I think we do need to touch on that. So I think we present ourselves as people who would touch on those things outside of what's being reported for whatever reason. And I want to apologize that we haven't done that in maybe the last few weeks, a month or so. And so that's on me. I come up with the topics along with Slewfoot Sammy, that's another reason he's probably needs to get fired. I want to say we do need to touch on something a little bit different. Okay, so that's my apology. And today I want to start this off with a conversation about what's going on in Haiti. As many of you know, Haiti is, I think, the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, if I'm not mistaken, Chris. But it was once, at one time, it had been the most lucrative colony in the world, full of very rich resources. Now, you may look at it and say, man, these people really messed up. You know, this is why they're poor. That's a shame. We know our former president had some choice words to say about countries like Haiti, which we don't accept. But there's always history to this, past this prologue. And so we don't want to look at what's going on in Haiti without historical context. And so let me give you some historical context before we get into exactly what's going on in Haiti. You should know that France took over the area that would be known as Haiti in 1697 and continued the enslavement of the people there, which supported the export of cash crops like sugar, coffee, and indigo. They had some of the cruelest slave treatment in Haiti in the world. The slaves were not at all seen or treated as human beings, as image bearers. Now, over time, Haiti ends up winning its independence from France in 1804 after 12 years of war. Haiti became the world's first Black-led republic and the first independent Caribbean nation. That should tell you something about the intelligence, the ingenuity, and the courage of its people. You know, you would think, you would hope that after they won this independence and after France realized that they were wrong, that they would immediately receive reparations from France for all that France took from them. But that's not what happened. In fact, the crazy thing about it is the opposite actually happened. Because of the revenue that France lost when Haitian slavery ended, the French made these newly freed people pay them reparations. This is what people are talking about when they come at the West. You just enslaved people for all this time, and when they get their freedom at gunpoint, you make them pay you reparations for being free. All right? France refused to recognize Haiti's independence unless they paid them 150 million francs as compensation for their lost revenues. Check this out. That was 10 times more than Haiti's annual budget. So it decimated the economy. Let me give you another comparison. That sum was 10 times the amount the United States had paid France for the Louisiana Purchase, which doubled the size of the United States. It took France it took Haiti 122 years to pay off their debt for liberating themselves. This is money that should have gone to infrastructure, money that should have gone to healthcare, money that should have gone to education, but it went to France for no good reason. And listen to this. NPR reported that after the 2010 earthquake completely devastated Haiti, scholars and journalists wrote a letter to the French president demanding that France pay back Haiti what it owed. The French economist Thomas Piketty resurrected the idea again in 2020, arguing that France owes Haiti at least $28 billion. And what did the benevolent French government do? Well, the French government, under multiple presidents, really just balked at the idea. And they said that basically it's highly unlikely that Haiti will ever get paid back anytime soon. So anytime we look at the French economy or look at the things they do and we wonder and say, that's great, just remember that a lot of Haitians died and others are suffering today because of the role that they played there. But it's not just the French. According to NPR as well, President Thomas Jefferson, as soon as the Haitians got their freedom, he worked to isolate Haiti diplomatically and to strangle it economically. Why'd he do that? Well, he was fearing that the success of Haiti and their freedom would inspire slave revolts in America. With the invention of and the spread of the cotton gin, slavery was becoming much more lucrative at the very same time a free Haiti was coming into existence. And slaveholders in the United States and other countries clung to and expanded the inhumane means of production. Haitian success was perceived as a threat to this system for decades, and the United States didn't officially recognize Haiti until 1862 as slavery was being abolished. But that's long ago. And I'm not even going to get into this next one. I'm going to ask you to do some homework. I just want you to Google Haiti and the Clinton Foundation. And I want you to see what the Clintons did in Haiti. This is Politico. This is not Justin's words or anybody else's. I want you to look into that and see the role that the Clintons have played in Haiti recently. And then come back and tell me how great your party is and how the other side is pure evil and you've never done anything wrong. Well, Chris, we know that today Haiti is in a really tough position. Its president was assassinated in July, I think, of 2021, June or July, one of the two. The U.S. and other world powers replaced him with a prime minister, Ariel Henry. I think that's the way they pronounce it. And Henry recently had to resign after being unable to get back into the country after gangs had taken over the airport. Yahoo News reports that the country had to declare a state of emergency last month after a band of armed gang members raided a prison and released 4,000 inmates. They're being led by somebody by the nickname of Barbecue, leader of G9, that has since collaborated with every other gang force, about 200 of them in the country, taking control of about 80% of the capital over the past few years, according to the UN. What is Barbecue's goal? Well, according to USA Today, Barbecue's goal is to overthrow the government and make it into a model government that he and his allies desire. Let me just tell you this. I'm going to pass it to Chris. The suffering going on in Haiti cannot be looked away from. The role that the West has played in that cannot be looked away from. And so if you have the inkling to look down on the Haitian people without really taking into consideration what they've been through historically and how other countries may have benefited from them in a way that is still hurting them today, I think you need to go back, read the Gospels, and pray a little bit, because this is ugly and there's a lot of folks that don't have clean hands. Go ahead, Chris.
I'm so glad that we are talking about this issue. It's one of the things that kind of lingers with me pretty perpetually. And I think that part of it is because as you laid out this history of Haiti and the involvement of various sort of Western governments and political systems and figures, there is also a real need to point to the involvement of the Christian church in the West in Haiti. When we think about what do we owe Haiti as a church? And there's an article that was actually published last year around this time in Christianity Today that actually bears that title, What Do Evangelicals Owe Haiti? And it looks at a very complicated history of the church in Haiti, because Haiti not only is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, it's also the most evangelized. And we have to think about a nation that has so many Christian missionaries and at one point was, and maybe still be honestly, the number one site or location for short-term missions. How is a country with that much missions activity facing this much political turmoil? And it really caused us to ask some questions. When you think about the complicated political history of Haiti, you also have to look all the way back to about 1842 when the first Western missionaries started their work. These were Methodists. They started work in Haiti. These missionaries built the first Protestant church in Haiti. They partnered with the government of Haiti to start a school inside of their church. Within a year, they were building a standalone school with monies that were all raised in Haiti. The government contributed, business folks in Haiti contributed, they were building schools. And in that first era of Christian missions, you saw a missionary impetus that was not only preaching the gospel, but it was also building up the infrastructure of this young nation, which at the time, as Justin already pointed out, the United States hadn't even recognized as a nation. And you had Christian missionaries there building schools, helping build infrastructure, building up the government. Fast forward to 1915, when the United States sends our own Marines to Haiti to basically occupy the country because we felt like Germany was getting involved in the economy. Germany, and this is the middle of World War One, they might establish some kind of a military outpost there. So we wanted to prevent that. We go to Haiti. But over time, these military occupiers, United States Marines and other military, started to really abuse their power. You saw the United States basically dissolve the government. You saw the United States eventually put in basically a project of forced labor there. And it was actually just in Black Christian missionaries who were some of the leading voices against this activity of U.S. Marines in Haiti. In 1920 and 1921, you saw S.E. Churchstone Lord, he was an AME minister, writing in the Chicago Defender and other places around the country, really calling the United States to Christians in the United States to ask their government to pull these Marines out. This was the first sort of existence of missions in Haiti. But then there comes another era, right? So you get the U.S. Marines out of Haiti, and there's a period where there's not a lot of missions activity. But around in 1957, this guy, Francois Papa Doc Duvalier, is elected president in Haiti. This guy basically makes himself into a dictator. And one of his major projects was the expulsion of Catholic missionaries and the courting of Protestant missionaries, especially. And this is why I think about this stuff all the time, because it was especially charismatic and Pentecostal missionaries that the Duvalier regime courted constantly throughout his regime, which was, I mean, it was a villainous regime. And you can go read about that on your own time, but it was a villainous regime, so much so that a lot of Western governments stopped sending aid directly to Haiti, but they would direct a lot of that aid through the aid organizations, many of them Christian organizations and Christian missions, who basically covered for this Duvalier regime through Papa Doc's regime. After Papa Doc dies, his son takes over, Baby Doc takes over, and Christian mission organizations basically take the road of saying, our job in Haiti is to preach the gospel, not to get involved in the politics. And so if we, you know, sending some of this money to the government, that's the cost of getting in to preach the gospel, and basically turning a blind eye to this, like I said, villainous regime for a long time, all the way through like mid-1980s, this is happening there. And so parallel to this history of foreign entanglement, the church has written itself into the story of Haiti. And as we look at where Haiti is today, I think that the article that was written last year asked a very important question that we need to consider. And I do want to say something that the article says, and I do not intend, Justin laid out a whole bunch of other things that happened in Haiti. And there are things that neither one of us have mentioned that happened in Haiti, natural disasters, so many things. So this is not to say that the condition of Haiti is something that lies 100% at the feet of Christians and Christian missionaries. Certainly, Christian missionary work helped relieve a lot of people, helped rescue a lot of people in really practical ways. Definitely, the preaching of the gospel is paramount and life-changing. And this is not to say that all Christian missions work in Haiti has been of none effect. This is not to say any of that. It is only to say that we do have a deeply interwoven part in the story of Haiti, and we need to be thinking about how do we not abandon our brothers and sisters in Christ, but in many ways also our spiritual cousins in Haiti in this difficult moment. We should be thinking about how do we play a role in the revival and recovery of Haiti, not just from a spiritual perspective, but in a holistic perspective.
Man, that's good history, man. And this isn't even to say that Haiti's own leadership class bears no responsibility for what's going on, right? Like, this isn't to put it all on other folks, but we can certainly say the way the French have dealt with Haitians, sometimes the way the church has dealt with it, and the U.S. has not just dealt with them as, and the U.S. did just, I think, committed to giving $130 million to Haiti to rebuild and to get things together. But it hasn't always just had a posture of benevolence towards Haiti. There was a lot of self-interest in there. There was a lot of foundations and others who were allowed to go in there and play with their politics in ways that weren't the best for the people. And we need to recognize that. We need to deal with that before we just look at a country and say how bad they are. And guess what? Haitian folks are going to be the last people that they're going to let across the border. For some reason, everybody else, you know, we can play around with it. But when it comes to Haitians, they don't play at all. They shut that off immediately. We can talk about the AIDS crisis, so many other things that Haiti has really just suffered through. And if who you're listening to right now, for some reason, puts you in a posture where you don't have compassion for that, I think that's a major problem. I think that you need to look at who your influences are, because it's not about saying people don't have any, you know, responsibility for it. But are you sure that your people in your history would have been in the same place if they had undergone what these folks have been in? I don't know that any of us can say that we would. But Chris, I'll let you take us out.
Yeah, I think the history of any nation is complex and complicated. Haiti is no different. But there are unique sort of connections that we have with Haiti as we are looking, as we are being a nation and a church that is very concerned about a lot of things that are happening on the other side of the world, which is not to say that we shouldn't be concerned about those things. We should. But Haiti's right here in our hemisphere. Haiti is a place where we have deep connections and mutual history. And it is a place that's in deep trouble right now. And I think it is worthy of our consideration, conversation, and advocacy as we think about how we are going to show up as the United States in the world and as the church in the world.
There it is. And we will be right back on the Church Politics Podcast. Are you too progressive for conservatives and too conservative for progressives? As a Christian, do you find yourself feeling politically homeless? If so, then you're not alone. Listen, this is Justin Gibney, president of the AND Campaign. And if you're a Christian who doesn't know a whole lot about politics or someone who knows a good deal about politics but wants to be more faithful in the public square, then you have to read the AND Campaign's book, Compassion and Conviction. The AND Campaign's guide to faithful civic engagement that we publish with InterVarsity Press. Whether you just want to understand the relationship between church and state, why Christians should engage politics at all, how Christians should engage partisanship, politics and race, advocacy and protest, or even civility, this is the book for you. It's very much Bible-centered. It's Bible study and small group friendly. There are questions and exercises after every chapter that give you a framework for engaging politics in a biblical way. So if you want to do it in a better way, get our book, Compassion and Conviction, the AND Campaign's Guide to Faithful Civic Engagement. And we are back on the Church Politics Podcast with Justin Gibney and the Right Reverend Christopher Butler. There's been some interesting comments made, Chris, about Social Security and this, you know, the age that it should be and all that stuff. And let me say this, you know, according to the Social Security Administration, in 2024, an average of almost 68 million Americans per month will receive a Social Security benefit. And that'll total about $1.5 trillion in benefits paid during this year. Now, large majorities of Americans say that they don't mind paying for Social Security because of the security and stability the benefits provide to millions of retired Americans. We're talking about disabled Americans, too, children, widows, spouses, and deceased workers. In fact, about 87% of Democrats, 81% of independents, and 72% of Republicans agree with that statement, that they don't mind paying into it because it helps so many retired Americans. And about 8 in 10, 77%, say that it is critical to preserve Social Security, even if it means increasing the Social Security taxes paid by working Americans. So, Chris, I think what is clear when it comes to Social Security, if anything, public opinion is supporting it and willing to expand it if needed. But our good friend, Ben Shapiro, has a different take on retirement and Social Security, and I'd like you guys to listen to that now.
And let's be real about this. It's insane that we haven't raised the retirement age in the United States. It's totally crazy. Joe Biden, if that were the case, Joe Biden should not be running for president. Hey, Joe Biden is 81 years old. The retirement age in the United States at which you start to receive Social Security and you are eligible for Medicare is 65. Joe Biden has technically been eligible for Social Security and Medicare for 16 years, and he wants to continue in office until he is 86, which is 19 years past when he would be eligible for retirement. No one in the United States should be retiring at 65 years old. Frankly, I think retirement itself is a stupid idea unless you have some sort of health problem. Everybody that I know who is elderly, who has retired, is dead within 5 years. And if you talk to people who are elderly and they lose their purpose in life by losing their job and they stop working, things go to hell in a handbasket real quick. But put all of that aside, just on a fiscal level and on a logical level. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt established 65 as the retirement age, the average life expectancy in the United States was 63 years old. Today, the average life expectancy in the United States is close to 80. It's totally insane that you believe that you should be able to work from the time that you are essentially 20 to the time that you are 65, which is a 45-year period, pay in, and then you will receive Social Security benefits sufficient to support you and your family, you and your wife or whatever, for like another 20 years. That's crazy talk. That is not fiscally sustainable. The notion that if you have to raise the retirement age to 67 or 68, that everyone is going to fall apart. My parents are that age. My parents are not retired. and they shouldn't retire. It would be very bad for them to retire. By the way, it's disrespectful to people who are 67, 68, 69 years old to suggest that they are in the same shape as people who are 65 were in 1940. It's not true at all. Have you met a 65-year-old lately? 65-year-olds are not old in the United States. They're not. 68-year-olds are not old in the United States. Again, Joe Biden thinks he's not old, and that dude is running for president again, and that dude actually is old, and he's 81. I failed to see how a country in which our entire leadership class is 80 plus is telling you that we should have a retirement age of 65. It makes no sense at all.
So basically what we can take from that, Chris, is that only losers retire at 65. Chris, Ben Shapiro's, I mean, I don't know that either of us are surprised to hear this from Ben Shapiro, who is not known for, you know, his compassion or anything like that. But I think this really, even more than that, is just ignorance. It shows a lack of self-awareness. It shows a lack, again, of compassion. And it just really shows that he's out of touch, right? Not everyone has the luxury of sitting at a desk and doing work from there their whole life. Not everyone is working a job that's fulfilling and gives them greater purpose. I wish they all could, but everybody's not working that kind of job. If you're doing manual labor, if you're working in a job that's very different from the one that Ben Shapiro has, then there is reason that you might want to retire at 65. I think work is important for the human soul. I don't disagree with him about that. But people also are forced to work in situations that they don't want to be in to survive. And I have no problem taking care of the elders or understanding how somebody who's in that situation might want to retire at 65. And to be honest, when you turn 65, there's a lot of employer discrimination. Yeah, I know it's against the law, but it still happens. And so it's not easy in those spaces. And if you're just working at a job that, you know, can't keep you afloat, that's rough. I go to these, you know, especially when we're in politics and doing stuff like that, I go to these retirement homes all the time. And you'd be surprised how fixed these people's budgets are. And it's not because they're lazy. It's not because they don't. Many of these folks worked extremely hard their entire lives. And only because they have these retirement homes and only because they're receiving Social Security, are they even above water as it is? So, again, I just think that statement comes from a place of just complete ignorance. You know, I'm in a position where I hope not to have to retire. I hope I can do what I'm doing now or something similar for the rest of my life or teach for the rest of my life. That'd be great. Not everybody's been given that luxury. And to not realize that just shows, especially when it comes from some conservatives, how out of touch they can be when it comes to what other Americans are going through. But go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I think it's charitable to chalk these statements up to ignorance. I think I might see maybe a little bit more willful intellectual dishonesty. I think if you listen to the statement from Shapiro, and we're going to have to pull a clip one day where we can like just go in hard on agreeing with Ben Shapiro. But if you listen to these particular statements, you would come away from them thinking, one, that conservatives supported Social Security when it first came out and just started to like not really support it because, you know, it became this kind of financial numbers problem for the government, which is not at all true. Historically, conservatives didn't like Social Security when it came out and have basically not really been huge fans of that or most other sort of social safety net programs throughout the history of those programs. So that's intellectually dishonest. You would also assume, listening to these statements, that everybody who retires is dead in 5 years after they retire. And that is just statistically not true. That is certainly not my experience. I happen to lead a church that has its own fair share of retirees and older folks. And all of my church members, I'm, you know, assuming that I haven't missed any phone calls, Lord be with me, but all of those members are still alive, even in their retirement. So that's not true. And then you would also assume that one's job is the greatest and maybe even the only value that a person has to our society, which while I agree that work is important to the soul, I think that especially in this moment of late stage capitalism, we need to really be mindful about work and vocation when we think about it and when we talk about it, because I will definitely argue that we need people in our society doing things that late stage capitalism does not value highly. And the things that capitalism doesn't value highly is very hard to get compensated for. And so I think we need a host of schemes in our policy to make this type of thing doable. That's why I believe in things like AmeriCorps and things like that, that make it possible for people to do things in our society that capitalism doesn't value highly. I literally just had a conversation yesterday with the church staff about how meaningful it is that we have grandparents volunteering in children's ministry. And we see that not only in children's ministry, we see that in mentoring programs, we see that the school that my wife operates, there are a couple of retirees who volunteer regularly there. And these things are important in the society. The ability to retire enables that type of work in the society. And it's one important method that we have, and I think we need more, to allow people to do things in our society that won't get easily compensated in the capitalism framework. And then the last thing that you would come away from this conversation of Shapiro assuming is that it's really, really complicated to bring solvency to Social Security. When the fact is, if you raise or eliminate the cap on taxable income and what's paid into Social Security, you can bring solvency to Social Security fairly easy. Right now,
But you would admit that there's been some mismanagement and that as is, it's not sustainable.
No, you definitely need to. There has been mismanagement. As is, it's not sustainable. It needs a lot of reforms. But the assumption and the argument that the only and maybe even the best reform for Social Security, because even if you raise the age, you also have to deal with management and those types of things. If you raise the retirement age, you still have to deal with those management internal issues. But in terms of fixing the math, the basic math, to say that the best way or the only way to do that is to raise the retirement age, basically taking benefits away from people by saying you don't collect it for as long, it's just not the easiest way. Probably the easiest way, and maybe a little bit more fair, is to let somebody who earns millions of dollars pay a little bit more into the program so that you don't have folks who are making millions and millions of dollars paying the exact same amount as somebody's making $168,000. So I think that there are a lot more compassionate ways to go at this. But I'm certainly willing to debate those methods of resolving the Social Security issue. But I do think when we enter upon that debate, those places of intellectual dishonesty have to be dealt with first, right? You can't enter with these false assumptions and then try to enter into the debate there.
Yeah, and the one interesting part about it is he does try to cloak it in a concern for people's survival after they retire, right? When at the end of the day, we know that, you know, one of the main, and I'm not in his head, but one of the main motivations for this is, and maybe perhaps another tax cut or just not to pay as much, right? So I think that's interesting. And the other thing about it is, I believe that work is good for the soul. I don't believe it's good for somebody to just kind of sit around. Cool. That's their choice, though, right? Like once somebody's been paying into this forever, if that's what they want to do, that's their choice to do it. But a lot of people might even open up time to do more volunteer work. And that volunteer work is where they find their fulfillment, is where they find their purpose. So there's a lot of things that go into it. But certainly one elite sect of society should not be telling people exactly how long they have to work, especially when they're doing a work that in nature is very different than the people that they're supposedly talking to and dictating what should happen. So the good thing is not a lot of Americans are buying that argument. I think we can go deeper into some of the mismanagement, some of the promises that have been made that have not been kept. And I think when you look on the left, you can see a lot of people talking about this with no plan to make sure that it's really sustainable. Because even raising tax, I mean, that is one way to go about it. That's not, you know, there are consequences or could be consequences to that too. So it's not an easy fix, but to say that there's only one way out of this is not intellectually honest. That's right. All right. Well, we will be right back on the Church Politics Podcast.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine. Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Olly.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
And we are back on the Church Politics Podcast. And I'm looking and seeing that the House just passed a bill that will require ByteDance, which is the parent company of TikTok, to sell the social media company or face a ban on all U.S. devices. TikTok has said that banning the social media platform would amount to a violation of freedom of speech rights for millions of Americans. And the issue here is TikTok or ByteDance is connected with China. And basically, ByteDance has to do. China ain't like us. If you're connected with them, you do what they ask you to do or tell you to do. And so the problem is we have this TikTok situation where they are controlled by China. And that affects the algorithm, that affects the content. And 60 Minutes talked about this a little while back. And I want to play a video on how the differences in TikTok in China and the TikTok as we have it now. Please roll that video, my man.
And Harris says the version that's served to Chinese consumers called Douyin is very different from the one available in the West.
In their version of TikTok, if you're under 14 years old, they show you science experiments you can do at home, museum exhibits, patriotism videos, and educational videos. And they also limit it to only 40 minutes per day. Now, they don't ship that version of TikTok to the rest of the world. So it's almost like they recognize that technology is influencing kids' development, and they make their domestic version a spinach version of TikTok while they ship the opium version to the rest of the world.
The version served to the West has kids hooked for hours at a time. The impact, Harris says, is predictable.
There's a survey of preteens in the US and China asking what is the most aspirational career that you want to have. And in the US, the number one was influencer.
Social media influencer.
And in China, the number one was astronaut. Again, you allow those two societies to play out for a few generations, I can tell you what your world is going to look like.
All right, Chris, I don't think we know how much damage TikTok is doing to our children right now. I've been surprised, and I'm far from perfect, even when it comes to social media and children, for sure. But I'm surprised how many parents will just let their kid go in a corner with a tablet and just be on TikTok and not even really be monitoring the content or what they're watching. The things that they're seeing, the things that they're hearing cannot be healthy. And I'm afraid, Chris, that we'll find out just how bad TikTok is for us when it's too late. Now, this ban is interesting. Well, it's not necessarily a ban, right? They're giving them the opportunity to sell in 6 months, or, you know, it would be banned in the U.S. It's interesting because there's a lot of different reasons for it, right? Some people obviously are saying, obviously, the China thing's a big deal, but that's been there for a while. Now you have other people who are saying one of the big issues for this is this indoctrinating our kids. And so I think it was Nikki Haley had something where, like, you know, every hour that a kid spends on TikTok, they become this much more anti-Semitic or something like that. So there's a lot of interest that are kind of fighting in this. We'll see what happens. I still don't think it's necessarily going to go any further than this. But if it were to get banned, the other thing is that would be a huge advantage for Mark Zuckerberg, because he already has, you know, he's already been kind of trying to imitate what TikTok is doing on Instagram with the reels and on Facebook and all that stuff. And because it would be such a boon for Mark Zuckerberg, potentially, some are saying that's why Trump has come out against this particular legislation, not because of the China part or not because of any of that, but some are suggesting that it's because he doesn't want Mark Zuckerberg, who is not an ally of his, to have the benefit of a competitor being gone. Chris, what's your take on TikTok, this legislation, and just the whole conversation around it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the general idea that you want to make sure that the Chinese Communist Party doesn't have that kind of foothold in the U.S. economy is a reasonable policy objective. I do think that the emergence of this TikTok conversation to the exclusion of a conversation about broader thinking about how social media more generally is impacting our youth, is it leaves something to be desired. I think that there should be a broader conversation that is taking place. It's a tough policy deal, but you have to, when you look at the simple fact that you already pointed out, Justin, that TikTok, ByteDance is not pushing anywhere close to the same content that they are pushing to our children, to their own children. That's got to raise some alarm and make you want to ask some questions. So I think that it is good and right to be asking questions. I'm in the camp because I think if it's TikTok, Facebook, YouTube, whatever comes next, it is being channeled to our children by means of their devices. And, you know, it's a hard place to be, but as a parent of, you know, an almost teenager and a bunch of kids coming behind, it's becoming increasingly obvious to me that the intervention that parents can make is actually at the level of what devices do children have access to, for how long, and under what supervision. So I think there's this broader policy conversation that needs to be had, because we do have some responsibility as a society, as a nation, with the government, to think about on a holistic level, what are we allowing to happen in our society and in the country. There's also a responsibility at the individual household level. I think that that's the place of intervention that I've heard from people I trust and that I fully advocate is for parents to be intervening at the level of the devices themselves.
Yeah, you kind of stole my thunder, Chris. You know, we can talk about China. We can talk about what content people are actually putting on here and how it's negative towards, you know, negative for children. But I think the buck stops with parents. There's going to be, in this information age and this, you know, the way the technology is going, there's going to be ways that your kid can access information that they shouldn't get. But it's going to be on parents. Actually, I'm not just going to say parents. It's going to be on the community. Even more than any legislation can do. They're going to find a way around it. They're going to find something else to watch. This is a community issue. And the onus is on the community to get kids off these tablets and to get books in their hands. And you know what I'm saying? And get them away from this negative stuff. I told you what, man, I was on TikTok. I'm not on it now. I was on TikTok for maybe a month, 2 months. I can't remember. But it was just like a black hole, like without ever searching for anything. I was just on there. I wasn't searching for nothing, doing the stuff that I was seeing. I was like, dude, there's no way the kid should be seeing this stuff. No way that a kid watching this for hours could be healthy. But yet, we don't really take it that seriously. Like, it shouldn't take China being behind this for us to jump up and say this is a problem. We don't really, I mean, not enough people are up in arms about what. I mean, this is like inviting somebody into your house to teach your kid degenerate stuff. You would never do that, but we have done it. And it's going to take a deliberate, strategic, collective effort to try to reverse this or at least minimize the damage that's already been done, Chris. And that's a community effort. So I like the legislation. I don't like the idea of a foreign country just kind of having that much control over what our kids see. But at the end of the day, with technology, I don't think we can completely stop it. And there's no shortcut. We're going to have to come together, organize, and make a change in the culture and how we see social media. Because social media in general for young people is just a bad idea. And it makes it harder, as you and I both know, the more parents who do it and aren't kind of checking on it, makes it harder for the ones that are trying to do it to get it done. Because even if your kid doesn't have a phone at school, they can just look over the shoulder of somebody else or one of their friends and see all the stuff anyway. So it's difficult, but I'll let you close this out, Chris.
Yeah, I'm just reminded as you're talking, Justin, of something that we've been kind of talking about in various places, but this is one of those places where you recognize that not everything that has to do with public life is involving politics, policy, and legislation. This is one of those places where we need to organize as a community, and it may not be to get a piece of legislation across the finish line. It may be just to change our attitude and come together in terms of how we shepherd our children into some healthy version of adulthood.
That's real, man. I think that's a great place to end. As always, man, you know, we appreciate y'all joining us. We do not take it for granted the time that y'all spend and spreading the word. So do take the time if you can spread the word about Church Politics Podcast. That's really how it spread. I mean, we haven't had a whole lot of money for marketing, but word of mouth within Christian communities have really spread it all around. I was just at Ozark Christian College and I had a young person come up to me and say, man, I've been listening for months to Church Politics Podcast. And I'm like, wow, you know, it's all over the country, but we want to get a little more depth. So keep spreading the word. All right. We appreciate you. You know what it is, Ann Camp. There's a cross that neither political conservatism or progressivism is fit to bear. There's a civic hearing in need of faithful witnesses who love social justice and won't surrender the truth to be loved by the world. Politic with the boldness and compassion of Jesus Christ. Until next time, Ann Camp. We'll holler at you. Dear Lord.